All right, Barbell Medicine listeners, let's talk about the holidays and the stress that comes with trying to find a gift that isn't just a basic gift card or, you know, another protein shaker. So stop stressing out and focus on finding the perfect something, because the countdown is on and holiday shopping season is officially here. And my go-to for finding truly unique stuff is Uncommon Goods. They take the stress out of gifting with thousands of high-quality finds that you won't see anywhere else. Don't wait. The most meaningful gifts get scooped up fast, and now's the perfect time to cross names off your list. Uncommon Goods curates products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade in the U.S. They work with independent artists and small businesses, making every gift feel meaningful and truly one of a kind. I was scrolling the site the other day and immediately knew what I was getting my brother. I hope he's not listening to this, but since he's been off at medical school, he's been fully embracing the dog dad life. So when I came across the Dog Father embroidered hat, which is made by an independent maker named Gina Davis out of Minnesota, well, I thought it was hilarious, it looked great, and it's perfect for him. Seriously though, you'll find thousands of unique ideas that won't just gather dust. Plus, with every purchase you make, they give back a dollar to a nonprofit partner of your choice. They've donated more than $3.1 million to date. So don't wait, cross those names off your list before the rush. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/BBM. That's uncommongoods.com/BBM for 15% off. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary. Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, and this is the March 2025 research review, where we review the latest research that's come out and try to tie them into your lives, give you some practical tips and useful takeaways. On the other end of the line, you can tell by the dad noises, it's the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baracchi. What's going on, dude?
I feel like I can't suppress the dad noises enough. I don't know. You always comment on them, even when I'm like holding my breath. So somehow,
like, on the one hand, it is a good like auditory acuity like test. You know, I can't tell if it's just because of these, you know, studio monitor headphones that I'm wearing, or if it's because of your new microphone. It's just picking this up so clearly. But you can't fight what's happening to you. You're just, despite you not being a father, you do make dad noises, and I respect it. Your dad also makes dad noises, to be clear. When talking to him on the phone, I go, I feel like this is genetic.
Yeah, no, things are good. I'm wrapping up another 2 weeks in the hospital. Incidentally, yesterday I gave my traditional back pain lecture to the residency program, and that was very well received and useful information for them to take away. So I always enjoy giving that talk. And kind of one of the fun things about giving a talk like that so many times over the years is that I feel like each time I give it, I have some new clinical anecdote of a new story or a new patient encounter that I saw recently that was relevant, and I get to inject it into the lecture on the fly, and it makes it kind of more interesting and real for folks. So I did just have a new story of my wife and I were really recently on a little mini vacation, and we were at this kind of public pool type area and heard a woman talking about how she had been dealing with this relatively new onset back pain. She appeared to be in her mid to late 40s. And so I said, my ears obviously perked up just kind of overhearing this at the pool. And she's, you know, getting, seeing some clinicians. And of course she was diagnosed with scoliosis. She got pictures, and that the x-rays showed scoliosis, and the PT that she saw was like, well, this is obviously due to your scoliosis. And she had like never really had back pain before, presumably something that she's had for most of her life. And it's a kind of a classic scenario of clinician see abnormality, clinician assume abnormality causing symptom. and so now she was talking about how she has to, you know, change her posture so much when she's working and do a lot of stretching and things like that. And I was just, you know, I wasn't asked for advice or an input, so I did not contribute, but it was a kind of a unfortunate anecdote to at least overhear passively in that environment. So that was a story that I was able to use when talking about back pain again this time around.
That also really, really highlights your ability to restrain yourself from giving unsolicited advice.
Totally. Who am I to this person? You know, why would they listen to me over anybody else? Their clinician told them it's from her scoliosis. Now, good luck fixing that when you're about to turn 50. I don't know.
Yeah. Imagine trying to just weigh in and give somebody unsolicited advice when you have no rapport with them. They don't know who you are. Yeah. I mean, that's, well, we see it every day on the internet, but totally. In real life would be. That would be more strange. Although I guess in the gym, I mean, you train at home. You have
for the most part
of the time. Yeah. But the commercial gym that I train at, oh boy, a lot of do-gooders, and I'm here for it. A lot of people working hard. I'm here for that. Less here for the influencer stuff, you know, despite the fact that I participate in some influencer type behaviors totally. From time to time. But man, there's a lot of unsolicited advice. Although I would tell you, and I know people listen to this, I don't know if they enjoy the happy talk more than they enjoy the actual edutainment stuff, but like here we are. There is one place that I frequent where the unsolicited advice is far greater than what happens at the gym. Can you guess the place?
Your coffee shop. I don't know.
No. The driving range. And okay. This is in particular, if you are a woman and you turn up to a driving range, it is more likely than not that not one, not two, not, but maybe the entire male cadre on the driving range will give you unsolicited advice because you've entered their domain. You're basically asking for it. You just, you know, you're at the driving range.
Totally.
And I see it happen and I'm just like, dear God, can we, can we just not like just go about your life anyway? I'm dissatisfied for them, but I wonder what's worse, giving people unsolicited advice or interjecting yourself in somebody getting unsolicited
sure.
advice.
Yeah.
Like what's worse. In any case, some announcements before we get into this week's podcast. One, we still do have the pain and rehab seminar. It's a nice little segue from your hearing about that one with the back pain, newly diagnosed scoliosis. May 17th through 18th in Buffalo, New York. It's our pain and rehab seminar. It's a live in-person two-day seminar. It is approved for CEU. So if you're a physical therapist, an athletic trainer, a strength coach, or just a person who wants to know more about not only handling your own sort of injuries, but also maybe helping others, great seminar for you. So that stuff is all linked in the description below. We have more new templates, second generation templates that are coming out. Strength 2 and Strength 3 are dropping this month. Be patient. You'll get emails about those if you've previously purchased those templates. And then if you haven't, but you're in the market for a new training program, well, be on the lookout for that. You can go to our website, sign up for the newsletter to make sure you get all the latest updates on what's going on with BBM. Also, March is Nutrition Month, and so we're giving people 20% off all of our supplements. Use the code NUTRITION20 at checkout. That goes on to the end of the month. We're about halfway there. We have articles on heart rate variability and training with limited time. Those are both on the website right now, so check those out if you prefer to read rather than listen or you want to do both. Otherwise, I'm just, you know what, man, I'm in the throes of meat prep right now. And, you know, I don't know. I'm a 5, you know, I tend not to get too high or too low on my own training. It is what it is. But usually during meat prep, I have like a sense of how things are going to go. I don't know that that's unusual to me, but just, I get this sense. I actually have no idea. Like how this is going to go. Like my best numbers ever at a meet are 287, which is what, 630 something, 197.5 kilo to 435 bench, and then 733 deadlift. And I was just kind of rapping about what my attempts might look like or whatever with Mike. And I was like, if I can get within 5% of those, I'd be satisfied.
Sure.
You know, given that I've only really been prepping for this particular meet for like 7 weeks, mm-hmm. with Masters Nationals being the main meet. Mm-hmm. And I think that's reasonable. I don't know. Does that seem like a pie in the sky idea? I mean, you know me and you've seen my training. So getting within 5%, does that seem reasonable or am I out to lunch on this?
No, I mean, I think that, you know, we talk frequently about normal performance fluctuations in day-to-day training can often fall within 5% plus or minus, and then even within 10% doesn't usually freak us out, although those are maybe a little bit bigger of fluctuations. And so if your training is going relatively well and then you rest up a little bit and then you have the meet day environment and things like that, then the hope would be that you'd be on the plus 5% end of your usual day-to-day training, which would put you probably within the lower 5% bound of your all-time PRs at the level that you're, you know, used to performing at. So I find it plausible. I guess we'll see.
Yeah. TBD. The only other thing I have to report has to do with how I like the mode I get in when I'm training. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm locked in, you know, or at least trying to be locked in. So sometimes I have to kind of have to feign that environment of like, okay, I'm focused on task at hand. Training actually matters now. So let's go. I feel like a jerk. Like I see for whatever reason, I notice stuff going on in the gym, but I choose during this time to not interact or like mm-hmm. respond mm-hmm. almost like there's something wrong with me neurologically. Like, does this person not see, does he not see that I'm standing right there? No, I see you. I just want to focus on what I'm doing. How does that strike you? Is that like jerk behavior? I don't know. Like, is there a better way to go about this outside of training in like a storage unit where nobody else is there?
if you're training in a very goal-directed fashion with a clear, you know, purpose and outcome that you're working towards, I think that degree of focus is arguably not even something that you're choosing. It's something that is like happening as a byproduct of your intent, right? And so I recall like in my swimming days when I was hyped up and ready for a race, like you could do literally anything around me if I was standing behind the blocks and there would be like literally no reaction, no interaction, no words exchanged, no eye contact. It would just be like on the lane in front of me. It was less, you know, of a factor in the training context because the training for that sport is just fundamentally different than, you know, high intensity stuff with powerlifting. But similar to when you're, you know, actually at a meet and you're taking your last warm up or you're getting ready for your first or your second attempt or something like that. And yeah, there's ideally nothing that can break your focus in that type of situation. I'm sure that you have been, if you haven't already watched it, the second season of Full Swing that came out, the Netflix golf show, and just seeing the kind of mental, you know, the mindset that those guys have to get into. Recall, you know, the one of the guys that's being discussed early on in the show, how he grew up, you know, he was at like one of Tiger's tournaments when he was a kid and he like tried to high five him when he was walking past and Tiger just like blew right past him. Cause it's like, yeah, that's how this works. And like high level competition, there's not really, you know, a way for your focus to break when you're at that level of performance or intent.
Yeah. You're locked in.
Yeah.
Trying to achieve the flow state, if you will, and then just like riding that. All right. Well, I feel like a better person now. Thank you I am social. I like talking to people. I just, what I'm doing in the gym actually matters and that like I'm very close to a meet, like that does take precedence. And so if you're listening to this and you're like, dude, you kind of seem like a jerk in the gym, I'm like, it's just temporary. I swear. Now, if this was way a long time ago, then maybe I just was being a jerk. And so in which case I apologize.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's get into this week's podcast again. This is the March 2025 research review. Got some new papers hot off the presses. The first one is from Harvard. All right. This one is titled Butter and Plant-Based Oils, Intake and Mortality. It's by Zhang. And again, a research group out of Harvard. It was published in the JAMA Internal Medicine Journal, March 2025. This actually times up nicely with the latest RFK Jr. clip. He's sitting in a Steak and Shake eating French fries, talking about the benefits of beef tallow, frying potatoes in beef tallow versus whatever they were using before, presumably seed oils. Mm-hmm. I mean, 830 calories is what the Steak and Shake website like lists as their calorie intake for French fries.
For a side dish.
For a side dish. Now, look, my grandma, RIP, loved Steak and Shake. We would take her there all the time.
Yeah.
You know, that was her sort of thing. She loved it. And at that point, I'm not really worried about the calorie intake. In fact, I almost like want the calorie intake.
Sure.
In that sort of setting. But like to suggest that this is not only a healthy option, just period, like regardless, but a healthier option. I'm like, by what metric? You know, how does that strike you?
I mean, I don't know, man. I sent you this clip that I assume we'll play for the audience and just the world that we are currently in, such that the actual Secretary of Health in the country is hawking beef fried French fries as like, this is the main important thing that we should be talking about right now. Just kind of baffling to me, honestly. I was pretty speechless that's kind of where we're at. I don't know.
Bizarro world.
Yeah.
Bizarro world. Yeah. We'll play that clip and then we'll be right back.
Today, the best French fries in the world are in Europe. I order them every time I go to Belgium or France or any place else. And the French fries here just don't taste right. And you taste these, it's a completely different experience. And the customers are raving about it. Other companies, Steak and Shake has been great. We're very grateful for them, for RFKing the French fries. They turned me into a verb. but also Popeyes.
By the way, a plastic straw. Thank you. Thank God. I can't stand those paper straws. I hate them.
All right, we're back here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Let's talk about seed oils. So first off, what are seed oils? Well, seed oils are a type of oil or fat derived from plants. Seed oils, as their name implies, are made from seeds and include soy, canola, peanut, and corn oil. Other vegetable oils like olive oil and avocado oil are made from fruits, not seeds, but they're all vegetable oils. Mm-hmm. And I tried to find out like who coined the term seed oil as like this sort of like line in the sand where like, oh, this is a distinct part of vegetable. Do you know any of the history here?
Nope, yeah. I don't know.
Sometime that predates our like, you know, conscious awareness of this as an actual problem. Also, just Austin, since you're in the hospital and you're, you know, seeing patients, has anybody ever come in with like a seed oil overdose, like that, to your knowledge?
Can't say that I have specifically toxicity of that type of food. Although, you know, I can say they got toxicity from the overall energy intake leading to diabetes and its complications, but not of none of the seed oil itself.
Yeah. Yeah. So as far as seed oils, again, these are derived from plants. It's a type of vegetable oil, but they're a specific type of oil in that they are polyunsaturated fatty acids that sometimes you'll hear people abbreviate as PUFAs, whereas a monounsaturated fatty acid is also sometimes called a MUFA. So when we talk about poly versus monounsaturated fats, what we're really talking about is the number of carbons, the number of bonds between adjacent carbons in the chain. So fats are these long chains of carbons. And if there's a single double bond, I know that sounds kind of weird, just a single double bond. It just means that there's two bonds between adjacent carbons and there's only one of them. Well, we call that a monounsaturated fat. That's like olive oil, for example. If there are multiple double bonds between adjacent carbons in this long chain that makes up the fat, that's a polyunsaturated fat. All right. So that's things like sunflower oil, soybean oil, corn oil, flaxseed, and fish. So there's your chemistry lesson for the day. Does that satisfy you as our resident chemist?
I could poke some holes in that, but I'll leave it be for now. That's okay.
I appreciate that, considering chemistry was, you know, decades ago for me. So to date, the studies investigating human PUFA or polyunsaturated fatty acid consumption, particularly when they are included in the diet to replace saturated fats from red meat and other animal products, consistently show a reduction in heart disease risk. We'll unpack this a little bit more. Seed oils contain relatively high proportions of linoleic acid, which is a polyunsaturated fat. Those that claim that seed oils are bad often claim that linoleic acid is the reason why seed oils are so bad. That is the causal portion of the fat that, you know, that's why they're so risky. To the largest study we have on linoleic acid consumption in humans to date consisted of over 300,000 adults. And in those adults, those with the highest category of dietary linoleic acid consumption was associated with a 15% lower risk of heart disease events. So that's things like heart attack, stroke, et cetera, and a 21% lower risk of heart disease related death compared to individuals with the lowest consumption. I know there's a lot of numbers, so let me just simplify. Those who consumed the most linoleic acid had the lowest risk of heart disease, strokes, heart attacks, et cetera, and the lowest risk of death. Okay. In that study, they also found that replacing 5% of energy, so calories, from saturated fat with linoleic acid results in a further reduction in heart disease risk by about 9% and a lower risk of death about 13%. So if you just looked at that study, which again is the biggest study in humans on linoleic acid consumption, which is a, you know, a proxy for PUFA or polyunsaturated fatty acid consumption or seed oil consumption, that would suggest that, hey, maybe these things aren't that risky. That said, there's been some contention about that. It's been a while since you and I actually did a seminar, probably a little over a year and a half now. Mm-hmm. But it seemed like for a while there, every Q&A that we ever did at the end of our seminars was like, hey, what do you guys think about seed oils? Like, yeah. like bad or nah? Like, mm-hmm. Where do you think that comes from?
It's just been one of the hot topics, I think, in the health space. And it also kind of fits in neatly with a lot of the current kind of popular thinking around contrarianism and guidelines and they lied to you and all sorts of, you know, conspiratorial thinking like that. And I'm not opposed to people asking the question. I think that what I'm have a little bit more of an issue with is obviously, you know, a lot of the types of motivated reasoning that people have, where if they're either not asking the question out of genuine curiosity, whether they're kind of open to kind of a neutral, you know, assessment of the evidence, or if they're not actually open to having their mind changed on this, maybe they already have a preconceived conclusion in mind, as so many folks in this space do, such that there's really no evidence that you could show anyone that would actually move the needle for them. Even the fact that there are kind of multiple, as we often say, consistent converging lines of evidence, meaning that you do different types of studies examining the same question in different ways. And overall, that body of evidence tends to line up pointing in a similar direction. Of course, with all research, there's going to be some outliers here and there that might point in a particular direction. Oftentimes, those things that point in a different direction can be explained. So, for example, a lot of the commonly cited studies by folks who are opposed to the consumption of these foods, certain trials from decades ago, things like the Minnesota coronary experiment and, you know, one of the old corn oil trials and things like that, those trials have been picked apart to death and debated in the nutrition space for, you know, methodologic issues that would lead to questioning the validity of some of the conclusions in those studies, for example. Whereas more recent or more rigorously done trials, or again, when you line up findings from mechanistic, you know, like in vitro data or very biologically mechanism oriented studies with prospective cohort studies that fall under the general realm of epidemiology, compared with other types of epidemiologic studies, as well as randomized interventional trials, when the majority of those studies tend to point in a particular direction and there is a plausible mechanism why they would point in that direction, then that is going to be sufficient for most people to generally point their needle in that direction. Now, what you do with that information in practice or with your own diet or your own nutrition is a bit of a separate question. It is up to you ultimately. And so, you know, to that end, when we've talked about this before, we don't necessarily say that based on this evidence, everyone should go out and, you know, pour themselves a nice tall glass of corn oil or something like that. It's not to say that we want you to deliberately crank up your intake of this as much as you can, but rather we're saying that when intakes of saturated fats from, you know, a lot of animal derived sources and things like that are very high in the diet, that appears to elevate your risk, and you can mitigate that risk by a substitution effect here. Still, you don't have to eat these things if you don't want to, but there are plenty of other health promoting foods that we tend to recommend. For example, consuming fatty fish like salmon, consuming mixed nuts like walnuts and cashews and things like that, right? Consuming avocados and certain other things that they can tend to contain at least some amount of these fatty acids, and they tend to have health promoting effects. And so I think that the idea that humans should like avoid the intake of all polyunsaturated fats or something like that, you're probably not getting the most health benefits that you can out of your diet, whether those come from these types of oils or not. But a lot of it depends on the broader context of the diet as well. What types of foods are being substituted in? What types of foods are being substituted out?
Yeah. Yeah. We've said that about effectively every sort of like aspect of nutrition when people talk about, well, carbs, fats, sugar, fiber, whatever. It's like, okay, so when you make one change to the diet, there are a number of other knock-on changes, and the totality of all the changes that are made, whether you're replacing, displacing, substituting, whatever, kind of will point you in the direction of what happens to the overall health potential of a diet, mm-hmm. you know, good or bad. So as far as seed oil consumption in the United States, it has gone up massively over the last century. Estimates from the turn of the century in the 1900s suggest that the average intake was about 5 grams per day, mostly from foods that people eat, meat, eggs, nuts, seeds, dairy, et cetera. And now it's over 30 grams a day, which is mostly due to ultra processed foods, because most these oils are used a lot in making ultra processed foods. So indeed, overabundance and overconsumption of seed oils via ultra processed foods have certainly contributed to increases in obesity and chronic disease. But the causality cannot really be drawn from that correlation, meaning that, yeah, we know that people are eating more seed oils, and we know that obesity has gotten worse, and incidence of chronic disease has also gotten worse. But that doesn't mean that seed oil consumption has caused that directly. It could, for example, just be due to increased consumption of ultra-processed foods, which lead to higher calorie consumption, which leads to greater obesity, which leads to greater chronic disease risk. I mean, that's very plausible, too.
Yeah, we could easily make another one of these types of correlational graphs and put it out as a hot take on social media, because the intake of organic food has increased dramatically over the 20th century and up through 2025. If you look up statistics on, you know, availability, access, purchase, and consumption of organic foods, up dramatically. So has obesity. So by the same logic, then we can blame all organic foods for the rise of obesity. But well, yeah. When I say it that way, hopefully in your mind, dear listener, you're probably like, well, that doesn't make sense. You know, a lot of people are familiar with the phrase correlation doesn't equal causation, even though they might apply it rather selectively in these situations.
Yeah. So how that ties into this paper is that many vocal critics of seed oils claim that reducing exposure to seed oils, whether it be by limiting their use in cooking and or intentionally replacing them with other fats, notably things like beef tallow per RFK Jr. or butter, both of which contain high amounts of saturated fat, well, they think that would actually be better. That would improve the health, generally speaking, of the population. So this particular study we're going to review set out to study the associations of butter and plant-based oils like safflower, soybean, corn, canola, and olive oil. All of those except for olive oil are seed oils, and basically see like, well, what was the total risk of mortality amongst U.S. adults? So to do this, they took three data sets. It's the Nurses Health Study 1 and 2. So those are two of the data sets. And the Health Professionals Follow-Up Study. They used food frequency questionnaires and an alternative healthy eating index. These are both surveys that have been validated to analyze the diet. It's not perfect, but better than just asking, hey, how much seed oils do you eat? Because most people wouldn't be able to tell you that. But they can tell you the types of foods that they've eat on a regular basis. And that's good enough for this purpose. Deaths were identified via searching of state records. And impressively, they reported a 98% completeness during the follow-up, which that's a lot of scanning. Like, I don't know what intern or what like
would not want that job.
Yeah, exactly. So as far as the results from this study, so the sample that was analyzed, just over 200,000 adults. The follow-up was up to 33 years, so pretty good. 50,000 deaths were documented. 12,000 were due to cancer and 11,000 were due to heart disease. After adjusting for confounders like BMI, smoking status, socioeconomic status, exercise, etc., the individuals with the highest butter intake had a 15% greater mortality risk than those with the lowest butter intake, such that for each 5 grams per day of butter increase, that was associated with a 4% increase in mortality risk. With respect to plant-based oil intakes, again, this is stuff like safflower oil, soybean oil, corn oil, canola oil, and olive oil. Those with the highest plant-based oil intake had a 16% lower mortality risk compared to those with the lowest amount of plant-based oil intake. Now, some of you at home might be saying, well, it's olive oil. Olive oil is just so healthy. So that's probably what this group was consuming. But even when excluding olive oil, those with the highest plant-based oil intake had an 8% lower mortality. And for every 5 gram increase of canola, soybean oil, et cetera, there was a 15% and 6% decrease in mortality. So if you subbed out butter for, you know, 5 grams of butter for 5 grams of canola oil, there'd be a 15% risk reduction. And if you subbed out butter for soybean oil, there'd be a 6% decrease in mortality. I believe corn oil and safflower oil were neutral. So that suggested maybe that those are more neutral than beneficial, but did not appear to be harmful. The authors report, and I quote, "In three large prospective cohorts of U.S. women and men, we found that higher butter intake was associated with increased total and cancer mortality." So total mortality and cancer mortality. "In contrast, higher intakes of plant-based oils were associated with a lower risk of total mortality and mortality due to cancer and cardiovascular disease." So, I mean, could we just move on and just say, look, man, doesn't it look like butter is uniquely health promoting? If anything, it looks to be like it looks to seem like it increases risk, and that these plant-based oils, if there was this like smoking gun thing, like causal sort of relationship, then, you know, where is it? You would expect it to pop up here, at least on some level, but that didn't happen. So before we kind of do some interpretation stuff here, I want you to play devil's advocate a little bit, Austin. If you were an anti-seed oil person, how would you like pick this apart? Would you just say, well, look, it's food frequency questionnaire stuff. It's epidemiological data. So yeah, this is dumb. Just doesn't add anything to the body of research. So we're moving past it.
Yeah, I think that those are a couple of the most common counters that you'll hear from that side of things, that they just throw epidemiology in the trash in general. Conveniently, though, unless it leads to a conclusion that fits that something that they're biased towards. So we see a lot of folks from the low carb side or from the anti-seed oil side that when there is a nutritional epidemiology study that supports something that they tend to believe, then they will wave the paper around and say, see. But if it conflicts, then they say, well, all nutritional epidemiology is garbage. And so they just tend to throw that away. So that's one thing that we actually tend to observe a fair amount. The other thing that I would expect to hear is this concept of something called healthy user bias, and it essentially relates to the idea that, well, this is an observational study, and so fundamentally, we're not randomizing people to these different dietary interventions. We're not taking a cohort of people and randomizing them to eat butter versus canola oil, for example, while keeping all other aspects of their diet, you know, relatively similar. And while, yes, that is per the traditional kind of biomedical, pharmaceutically based research model, the most rigorous way to assess causality of a single variable intervention like that, as we've talked about, Many times in the past, we've had our friend, Dr. Alan Flanagan, write several articles for our website on nutrition science. We've had him on the podcast as well from a few years back. And so if you've not heard those that podcast or read those articles, if you just Google nutrition science, barbell medicine, Dr. Flanagan's articles will come up that explain this in a lot more detail as far as why using randomized controlled trials is actually a poor fit for many nutritional interventions, particularly those related to lifelong exposures like this. It can be useful if you want to try to lock up some people in a metabolic ward for a week or two and see what happens, but you can't do that for 33 years of follow-up, as was done in this type of situation. And so for these types of analyses, looking at these long-term exposures as they relate to diseases with long latency periods like cardiovascular disease, things that take years to develop, right? Nobody eats a pat of butter and dies the next day. But if you end up developing cardiovascular disease, it takes decades to do so, right? And so prospective cohort studies is probably the best fit for that type of research, you know, goal. There are obviously ways that these studies can be done better or worse in terms of the methods and things that you try to control for and adjust for in your analyses. And it's, of course, possible that there are, you know, unadjusted things. And so the counter that you might expect to hear is, well, people who tend to consume less butter and those who consume more of the plant-based oils, they may also be more likely to do a lot of other healthy behaviors because they're maybe more inclined to follow guidelines relating to exercise, for example, and not smoke and things like that, because they believe that that's the most healthful thing to do, even if they might feel that maybe the butter and the seed oil aspect of this isn't necessarily the primary mediating variable, again, because it wasn't necessarily randomized. And so that's a counter that I would expect to hear in this type of situation. I think that there are many counters to that counter that we could entertain in terms of a back and forth on this. Again, I kind of come back to the idea that this is not an isolated finding. This is something that we observe in mechanistic data. For example, when you look at what happens when we crank up the intake of saturated fats versus polyunsaturated fats. Well, cranking up intake of saturated fats tends to suppress the function of the LDL receptor, tends to lead to higher levels of blood lipids in circulation, and over many years of exposure, chronically high levels of blood lipids clearly relates to increasing risk of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease and premature death from it. And so we have that mechanism. And then we have not just this prospective cohort study, but many other prospective cohort studies and other forms of epidemiologic research also illustrating and generally pointing in this direction. And then you have randomized dietary interventions that have shown benefits on those cardiovascular risk markers, right? And then lastly, there are other national public health interventions that have been done around the world over time, the most dramatic of which I believe was done either in Sweden or Finland a few decades ago that had a huge drop in their cardiovascular risk. There was a multimodal kind of intervention that was done, but a large portion of the effect was explained by a reduction in their habitual consumption of butter intake. So again, we have tons of different kind of ways at coming at this question that by and large are pointing us towards a similar conclusion. So I wouldn't hang my hat entirely on any one study. And I would recognize that each of them has, you know, limitations and flaws and things like that. But I think the consistency of that kind of, we'll call it directionality, is useful for us. Now, the last thing I would say is, does this mean that if you consume 5 grams of butter and you otherwise have a flawless diet, you're lean, you're active, you're healthy, you sleep well at night, you do all these other things, that you're necessarily going to die sooner or earlier? I would not feel confident in making that case. But a lot more of this has to do with the overall dose, the overall lifelong exposure, and then to some extent, the dietary context that's going on. So somebody who has a habitual high intake of this food source, I think that you probably stand to benefit from some smart substitutions here. I think that that's probably, for the most part, an uncontroversial take among reasonable people in this space.
It leads into my broader point, which is that I don't know that micromanaging dietary fat intake is a good use of time, resources, willpower, effort, et cetera, for most individuals, because the dietary pattern at large is much more important. And so to your point, oh, you had a little bit of butter, you know, the butter police or the butter coroner isn't showing up to your house and saying, hey, man, that's a couple of days off your life. Similarly, you know, removing all seed oils from your diet is unlikely to make a big difference in your outcomes unless it changes how many calories you're eating, how much fiber you're eating, how much protein you're getting, you know, again, other sort of knock-on effects. And so what I would pose to these individuals that are like, rallying against seed oils is like, you really think that I should decrease the amount of nuts that I eat or avocado or like, you know, stuff
salmon,
like that.
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. From like minimally processed or unprocessed foods. That's the smoking gun. Really? Like you got to say that out loud in public and hang your hat on that. So I think overall, you know, the idea that seed oils directly and uniquely are the, you know, cause of the obesity epidemic and the, you know, increased burden of chronic disease, I think that is more likely to be false than anything else, mainly because people are not overeating, again, on nuts, salmon, other foods that have naturally occurring, you know, if you want to use that term, linoleic acid or polyunsaturated fats. The majority of seed oil intake in the United States is from ultra-processed foods. And we've already talked about ultra-processed foods and the specifics of which ones likely cause or are causal of the obesity epidemic. Those are the ones with added sugar. Those are the ones with added fats. A lot of times they are seed oils, for example, added sodium, and they're very tasty. They have high calories. People don't get full from them. And so if somebody who was against seed oil intake was only against the intake of those types of foods, I'd be like, man, we agree.
Yeah.
I don't think it's because of seed oils per se. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I just think that those happen to be used in the preparation of those foods, which then lead to overconsumption, which leads to, you know, the problems that we've had. I think that's the most likely relationship here. And so, again, I just wouldn't micromanage food and dietary patterns based on fat source. I think people should eat mostly lean proteins. I think most of their diet should consist of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes. And again, from mostly unprocessed to minimally processed foods, I would advise against drinking calories, protein shakes notwithstanding, if you need them. And ultimately, if you're trying to navigate this health, you know, online influencer ecosystem, be wary of these mechanistic studies where people use to support a particular intervention that is supposed to drive outcomes, especially if we have outcome data. In this case, we do. And I just don't see any directionality towards like seed oils being the cause. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think it's a fair take. In my day-to-day life, I generally don't tend to add butter to any of my meals. I tend to rarely cook with it, occasionally a small amount, but it doesn't really feature prominently in my day-to-day diet. But at the same time, neither do a ton of seed oils. I don't generally add them to my foods. I generally tend to cook with either olive or canola oil most of the time, generally in modest amounts, not overwhelming amounts. And so none of these foods feature super, super prominently in my habitual dietary pattern. And that's just how I go about my life and habitual intake. But I think that if somebody was of the opinion that, you know, sometimes you'll see these insane claims like butter is just like an insanely nutrient rich food and super, you know,
yes,
dense
in beef tallow,
in new carotene vitamins yeah. And I'm like, this is not an intelligent take that would not recommend deriving
it's like
the majority
eating,
of your nutrients from these foods. Yeah.
It's like eating peanut butter to get protein. It's
exactly,
like,
yeah.
While it does have protein in it, it's just not a great source. And I do see people make that claim, I'm like, yeah, dude, we know. we all got it. But to say that like, oh, butter's got all these vitamins or beef tallow has all these nutrients, I'm like, yeah. I mean, I guess technically true compared to these other oils, but like not a lot.
Yeah.
And certainly not enough to be like, yeah, I'm going to pour myself a glass of this stuff.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. I think we sufficiently beat that to death. If you're wondering about our take on seed oils, it's kind of a nothing burger outside of it indirectly being modified by the entire dietary pattern. Mm-hmm. So get a healthy dietary pattern, let the fats fall where they may be, and probably just wouldn't micromanage. Hey guys, a quick heads up before the year is over. If you've got unused HSA or FSA funds, don't let them go to waste. You can use them towards barbell medicine coaching, consultations, programs, supplements. They're all eligible under these accounts. It's totally legit, by the way. Your accountant will approve and your future self will thank you. Your quads, well, maybe not right away. Jokes aside, it's a smart way to invest in your long-term health and performance instead of rushing to stock up on random medical supplies that you'll never use. Before the year ends, head to barbellmedicine.com, choose your plan, and at checkout, select Flex Pay with HSA FSA because those dollars were meant to make you healthier, and that's exactly what we do. Barbell Medicine, evidence-based training that pays off, literally. Okay, fall always feels like a reset and not always in a good way. Between busier routines, back to school, and shorter days, it's suddenly way too easy to let your nutrition slide. You know the feeling. You're one I'm too tired to cook decision away from a family dinner that definitely doesn't fit your macros. That's why I've genuinely been loving Factor. These are chef-prepped, dietitian-approved meals that make it easier to stay on track no matter how hectic the season gets. And they've really stepped up their game. They've got more variety, more weekly options, and they include stuff like salmon and shrimp at no extra cost. Plus, and this is great for us, they even have more GLP-1 friendly and new Mediterranean diet options, all packed with protein and good for you fats. Look, we're evidence-based here, right? Well, 97% of customers say that Factor helped them live a healthier life. I'll take those odds. I use this when life gets busy, and you can too. It's a lifesaver for me for busy weeks. So here's the deal. Eat smart at factormeals.com/BBM50off and use code BBM50off to get 50% off your first box, plus free breakfast for an entire year. That's code BBM50off at factormeals.com for 50% off your first box, plus free breakfast for an entire year. Get delicious, ready-to-eat meals delivered with Factor. Offer is valid for new Factor customers with code and qualifying auto-renewing subscription purchases. Hey guys, it's Jordan. Now I know that we talk about making gains in the gym all the time, but what about a different kind of personal growth? I'm talking about learning a new language. It's a goal that a lot of us have, but it can feel as intimidating as a heavy deadlift. Well, that's where Rosetta Stone comes in. They make learning a new language easier and more immersive than ever before. Forget those boring memorization drills. Rosetta Stone helps you build a new language naturally, the same way you learned your first. You learn to speak, listen, and then think in your new language so you can actually use your new skills. My favorite feature is the True Accent speech recognition technology. It's like having a personal language coach giving you real-time feedback on your pronunciation so you sound more natural from the start. Rosetta Stone has been a trusted leader in language learning for 30 years and offers 25 different languages. And here's the best part. The Lifetime membership gives you unlimited access to all 25 languages for life. You can learn as many as you want, whenever you want. If you're ready to start a new kind of personal growth journey, Rosetta Stone is the perfect tool to help you get there. Don't wait, you can unlock your language learning potential now. Barbell Medicine listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's Lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning now. Here at Barbell Medicine, we take our recommendations seriously. If we're talking about a product, you know that there's solid evidence and quality behind it. And that's why we're big fans of FIGS apparel. For those of us that work in healthcare, FIGS makes scrubs and gear that's genuinely designed for what we do. Forget those boxy, scratchy hand-me-downs. FIGS has completely rethought uniforms with better tailoring, making them comfortable, lightweight, and incredibly durable, even through endless washes. Plus, they're antimicrobial, which is always a bonus, especially during a long shift. And it's not just scrubs. They offer so much more, from supportive New Balance sneakers and compression socks for long days on your feet, to great outerwear for when the hospital AC is on full blast. If you're ready to upgrade your uniform, FIGS is offering you 15% off your first purchase. Just go to wearfigs.com and use the code FIGSRX at checkout. That's wearfigs.com, code FIGSRX for 15% off. All right. Well, we're back here on the March 2025 research review with Dr. Austin Baraki. We're going to talk about our second paper. This has to do with the interference effect. Yep, we're revisiting the effects of adding conditioning to a resistance training program and its effects on muscle mass, muscle strength, and now muscle power, so high velocity strength. So this paper was titled Neuromuscular Adaptations to Same versus Separate Muscle Group Concurrent Aerobic and Strength Training in Recreationally Active Males and Females. Dear God. I'm going to be honest with you. So this is open access. Both of these papers are open access. So if you are trying to get the habit of reading, you know, academic papers, you can read both of these. If you happen to skip the second one, I wouldn't hold that against you. It was no shade to the authors, no shade to the journal, the Scandinavian Journal of Medicine and Science and Sports. That's one that I frequent and try to – because they generally are open access and the papers are usually good. This particular paper does not live up to that standard. And again, no shade at the authors. I understand what they were trying to do. I thought it was pretty interesting, which is why we're including it. But whew. This was a bear. So this is by Furbacher et al. It was published in the February 2025 edition of Scandinavian Journal of Medicine and Science in Sports. So let's give you guys a little background about what the interference effect is, where it came from, etc. So over 40 years ago now, Dr. Robert Hickson demonstrated impaired strength development in previously untrained males who incorporated both strength and endurance workouts into a 10-week training program. Dr. Hickson termed the impaired strength gains with concurrent strength and endurance training the interference effect, and boom, we were off to the races. That was about 1980. At the time, it was unclear if this, quote, interference was really due to, like, diminished adaptations by a different mechanism. So, like, endurance training predominantly increases protein synthesis in the mitochondria, so it's metabolic-related adaptations, whereas resistance training stimulates protein synthesis at the level of the muscle, so, like, myogenic-type adaptations. So it wasn't clear if it's due to that, this, like, mechanistic difference in training adaptations, or if it was due to an increase in total training load that the people couldn't really deal with. That's been a question for the ages ever since interference effect was sort of coined as a term. We previously covered this on our conditioning series. I believe it was the second episode of that. And there are two major meta-analyses that have been published since 2020 that kind of investigated this question before us. So the first one, this basically compared 27 different studies that looked at leg press or squat one rep max in resistance training only sort of groups versus those who were doing both resistance training and aerobic conditioning. And these were done in untrained, moderately trained, and highly trained individuals. Now, in this meta-analysis, the one rep max for leg press and squat was negatively affected by concurrent training in trained individuals by a small amount, literally less than 3 or 4 kilos, but only when aerobic and strength training sessions were performed at the same time, meaning that they did them in the same session. Sometimes doing the aerobic training before the resistance training was done, and it was overall a very small effect. So if you just had that single meta-analysis, you'd be like, meh, I don't know that this is really an important finding. It, even if it were true, like if Austin, if I could say, look, man, I'm going to improve your VO2 max by, you know, 10%, but your squat one rep max is like 3 or 4 kilos less. That's a nothing sandwich, right?
Yeah. 3 or 4 kilos is within more than within the random day-to-day variation that, yeah, I would take that VO2 max improvement.
Yeah, for sure. The second meta-analysis was done by the same research group, and it was 43 studies with over 1,000 subjects. There were only differences in strength outcomes or strength type outcomes in 6 of the 43 studies included. The authors concluded from this meta-analysis, and I quote, concurrent aerobic and strength training does not compromise muscle hypertrophy and maximal strength development. However, explosive strength gains may be attenuated or reduced, especially when aerobic and strength training are performed in the same session. These results appeared to be independent of the type of aerobic training, frequency of concurrent training, training status, and age. So at this point, you're like, well, look, if this interference effect is real, perhaps it only applies to highly trained individuals by a small amount for maybe for maximal strength, probably no real effect on hypertrophy, and maybe for like explosive strength, this high velocity force production. So that's kind of our existing opinion. We're like, look, it probably doesn't do much for maximal strength or maximal hypertrophy, but there could be some effect on high velocity strength unless total work exceeds the current recovery status of the individual. Like if you're just doing too much training, then I don't know that that's, quote, interference effect, like the adaptations are interfering with each other, but really more of a training load management. And it really it's unclear still to this day, like what's going on. So thus, the primary aim of this study was to assess whether separating aerobic and strength training by muscle group mitigates the interference effect on explosive strength through concurrent training compared to doing concurrent training but with opposite muscle groups. So the study design here is a little interesting. I want you guys to listen closely because it's pretty unique. So they took 56 dudes and 40 women in their late 20s. They were all recreationally trained, so they had a good VO2 max. They were squatting at least body weight for one rep max and benching at least 3/4 body weight for men for one rep max bench and half body weight for women for one rep max bench. So, you know, not competitive power lifters per se, but these people had seen a barbell at least once or twice. They did a 12-week training program with one of the three following programs. So the first program, they did lower body high-intensity interval training with lower body strength training. They did that in the same session. The second group did lower body high-intensity interval training and upper body strength training only in the same session. And the third group just did resistance training only, so strength training for lower and upper body together. So they did full body training sessions. The high-intensity interval training, and this is something we talked about this before we went on air, the methodology of the study, it said that they only did 4 minutes of high-intensity interval training. They did like 4 minutes of hard effort. followed by a 3 minutes of active recovery. But it didn't say that they did multiple rounds. We couldn't find in any of the methods or any of the supplemental data that they did like more than one round. But it seems weird that they would mention the recovery period if they only did one round. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't believe that they only did one round. It certainly doesn't say that or suggest it. But to your point, it doesn't actually say how many rounds they did, or doesn't illustrate like, here's what an example of the high intensity interval session looked like, or, you know, what the total duration of high intensity interval training was, so that you could just do the math, say four on, three off. That's whatever, 7 minutes. And then if they did it for 28 minutes, then you can kind of do the division and figure out. But they don't give any of that information. So it's a bit puzzling exactly what the high intensity interval work was. A little bit puzzling if people who designed it were competent enough to put together a solid strength training program and such to not, I guess, recognize that maybe it's worth detailing what the what the interval training was like. Yeah.
The resistance training was done twice per week. So the groups that did the high intensity interval training did that plus the resistance training. So for lower body, they did squat, leg press, leg curl, knee extension. And for upper body, they did bench press, incline bench press, seated row, and triceps extension. I think based on how they tested one rep maxes, that all of the quote barbell exercises were done on Smith machines, but we'll forgive them for that. It's exercise science. That's pretty common. So what you would expect to see here, if there was a big interference effect, is that you would expect that compared to the group doing resistance training only, that the people doing lower body high intensity interval training and lower body strength training would have a smaller improvement in their squat, in their movement velocity, and their lower body hypertrophy. Similarly, you would also expect that the group doing the upper body strength training and the high intensity interval training, well, you would expect them to have lower amounts of strength gain in their one rep max bench press, lower amount of explosive strength in their bench press, and less hypertrophy in their upper body if the concurrent or the interference effect was sort of like systemic, meaning that it didn't matter which muscles were worked, you know, whatever. It's just a systemic sort of interference effect. Mm-hmm. If you thought there'd be an interference effect only if the same muscles were being used, then you would expect an interference effect to show up in the lower body group only and not in the upper body group. And if you predicted that there would be no interference effect, you would assume, well, look, they're going to gain the same amount of strength, same amount of muscle mass, same amount of power improvement. Mm-hmm. So let's see what results they came up with. So as far as the power or high velocity force production, they all got better at the 70% and 90% of one rep max loads. They also interestingly tested them at 30% one rep max and 50% one rep max. Those did not improve, which I thought was interesting. I'm like, oh, is it too light, you know, for them to get better, or just not sensitive enough to pick up an improvement in movement velocity? But as far as you know, was there a difference between groups? No, there wasn't a difference between groups. Basically, everybody improved. There wasn't a significant difference between those who did high intensity interval training or not. So like, if there was a concern that power production or power adaptation would be attenuated, well, they didn't find that. For strength, for maximal strength, again, there was an improvement in both the one rep max bench press and one rep max squat, and it didn't seem to matter if people did high intensity interval training or not. For hypertrophy, same sort of relationship here. Hypertrophy improved in the lower body and the upper body. There were some differences between the groups doing high intensity interval training and those just doing resistance training only. So for lower body hypertrophy, this was measured by ultrasound in the vastus lateralis. Those doing the high intensity interval training and the lifting gained more hypertrophy than those doing resistance training only, which, hey, maybe a little bit of extra stimulus there. And then for the upper body, there was a greater increase in those doing resistance training only. But we're talking about 16.8% versus 13.2%. And the authors mentioned that the actual range of hypertrophy and strength improvements were all over the, you know, were crazy, crazy wide ranges. Yet they did not report those ranges, because that would have been interesting to see. So overall, before we kind of get into the take home and our interpretation here, I think the major sort of summary of this data is that, yeah, everything improved. People increased their power. People increased their maximal strength, and people increased their hypertrophy with seemingly little to no effect from also doing this high intensity interval training. Now, if it was only 7 minutes of aerobic training done a couple times a week, I don't know that this sufficiently answers our question, but I can't think that that actually happened. I just think there's got to be an error in the methods.
Yeah, I think they just didn't describe how many intervals was done. I'm generally inclined to agree. My thoughts on this are that we should probably be cautious with how far we kind of extrapolate this out in terms of the population of interest, right? Mm-hmm. So you mentioned we took these folks who were, you know, I guess I would call them mildly fit at sure. the outset, right?
Recreational trained. Yeah.
Recreationally fit, you know, a body weight squat and a sub body weight bench press for men and women. So they weren't completely sedentary where they'd never seen a weight before, but I wouldn't necessarily call them particularly well trained. And so, because if you wanted to, you would say, well, let's say I wanted to extract the conclusion from this trial and apply it to you and say that, well, here you are approaching your powerlifting meet very soon. Can I just add several rounds, multiple days per week of 4 minutes on of hot, truly high intensity interval training for your lower body, for your legs? Have you doing sprint cycling for 4 minutes on, 3 minutes off, for however many rounds they did a couple times a week leading up to your meet, and expect that you're going to perform the same or better, or that your leg muscles are going to get bigger doing this compared with if you didn't leading into your meet? And I don't think that that is likely to be the case. I think that both of us would recognize that at a certain level of performance, right? Or like, again, if you're going, it's meet week, you're 2 weeks out from your meet, whatever, and then cranking on high intensity, lower body interval training. I suspect that our squat performance might be at least a little bit affected in that situation. But what we're talking about there is absolute top end performance in a highly, highly trained individual.
I appreciate you saying that. That's nice. Yeah,
where that top end performance is, I don't know what the right word would be. It's like more delicate. It's more fragile. It's more susceptible to all sorts of different, you know, variables and things like that, right? As we've talked about before, for you to go to a meet and put together the best meet day of your life, you need like all the stars to align, right? And if one of the stars is out of alignment, be it related to nutrition or be it related to sleep or be it related to something else like this, then
charge crystals, yeah.
Things can get, you had a little too much seed oil the day before. things can get thrown off a little bit. We do our best to like placebo ourselves past those kind of things and say we're going to perform just as well. But, you know, and so I'm not terribly surprised that if you take a not super well-trained population, that they can get really good training outcomes either way, including using these simultaneous training modalities that are otherwise commonly thought to interfere with one another. The interesting kind of conclusion that you could potentially take from this is, you know, we see a fair amount in the strength training world recommendations for beginners to just focus on getting strong first. You don't need to worry about doing conditioning for a while. You can add in the conditioning later on, right? And not only does that lead to people often like not ever adding in the conditioning, but it almost feels a little bit backwards. And it's not to say that you shouldn't do conditioning later on, but you should be more selective with it, as we're talking about in your case. Like, you're going to tend to do a little bit less during, you know, 1 week out, 2 weeks out from your meet, right? Whereas if you're introducing somebody to strength training, whereas a lot of that common advice is just wait on the conditioning, do it later on. It's like, well, there doesn't seem to be a huge downside, especially, you know, it's like, well, if the outcome of interest is how absolutely strong are you going to get in the first 3 weeks of your training? Well, nobody cares about that. Over the course of your training career, probably getting training, doing all the conditioning, doing the strength work up front is probably going to set you up more favorably for not only your strength, your hypertrophy, your conditioning, and your general health outcomes as well. So I think that's kind of actually might be the more interesting takeaway that I might take from this, is in contrast to that usual advice, kind of flipping it a little bit and recognizing that this study probably doesn't apply too well to like very elite level strength and power athletes.
Yeah. Yeah. I think if, you know, it's not a binary sort of conclusion here that we're like, oh, look, there's no interference effect, period.
Yeah.
Or there is an interference effect, period. I think like most things in training, it depends. And I could think of like three separate use cases that would have slightly different uses for this data. So like the first is, as you alluded to, the untrained individual from both an aerobic and resistance training perspective. They're just starting out. I would highly recommend they do both, because you're going to get different health benefits from both. You need both. And further, I actually think that the aerobic training related adaptations are complementary mm-hmm. to further strength training, because you're going to need to be able to lift with more volume. You're going to need to be able to recover between sets, all sorts of stuff, in addition to just general health benefits of aerobic fitness. And similarly, your resistance training related adaptations, improve strength and muscular function, are going to improve your aerobic performance. So it's like win-win. So 10 out of 10 would recommend doing both. And any concerns of the interference effect are greatly outweighed by the potential benefits from doing both. So I'm just, even if I'm taking a few percent off whatever resistance training adaptation, whether it's maximal strength, maximal hypertrophy, maximal power production, I think it's worth it in that particular phase of training, even though I would, based on this data and the two previous meta-analyses, I probably wouldn't predict there to be a big difference anyway. Second use case is somebody's in the middle, right? And they're like, look, I've been training for a while. I'm really focused on getting strong, gaining as much muscle mass as possible. Those are my primary aims because I like it, but I haven't been doing conditioning. You're saying I should add conditioning and should I just add a whole bunch of it? And it's like, well, at this point, you're requiring enough resistance training load, we'll call it. And that's not just weight, but that's volume, that's frequency, that's intensity, et cetera, to not only maintain your current level of strength, but also improve it. And so you have to be pretty careful with how much conditioning that you add, because all you're doing is increasing the total training load. And so, you know, starting at 90 minutes a week, maybe it's 3 30-minute sessions, is a reasonable place to start, and then gradually increasing from there up to, and ideally to exceed the current physical activity guidelines of about 150 minutes per week. That would be a reasonable strategy there in order to not only continue your march towards getting stronger, but also now to include some aerobic related adaptations to improve your cardiorespiratory fitness. So that's the second use case. The third use case is me, right? As you said, and I believe there was at least three highlies in there, highly trained strength athlete who's getting ready for a competition that presumably matters to them. I don't think that adding conditioning is likely to benefit the meet performance from a strength perspective. In fact, I would predict that there would be a likely harm, mainly because at this particular point in my training, this last little run up to the meet, my training intensity and total training load is effectively the highest it will ever be, you know, during training. And so, in fact, what I'm doing and what I would recommend is actually a decrease in conditioning volume, not because I'm worried about interfering adaptations, though, but just to mitigate total training load. So 5 weeks ago, I was probably doing close to, you know, 3 3.5 hours on average per week of conditioning, split up a bunch of different ways. And now I'm doing like 80 minutes per week. Mm-hmm. And I feel like such a slug, because I'm like, all right, 15 minutes on the bike, 15 minutes on the rower, whatever. And I'm like, I kind of want to keep going because I know it's, quote, good for me from like a health perspective, body composition management. I just, you know, it's part of my routine. But I also know that, like, I don't need to have my highest VO2 max ever on the platform. I just need to, like, squat the house and deadlift a car.
Yeah.
And hopefully, you know, win the admiration of dudes at this at this meet. So next week, I'll be 2 weeks out. My conditioning volume is going to drop again. And then the week of the meet, I might do a single 15 or 20 minute session just to, like, get some blood flowing, or I might not do it at all.
Yeah.
And so those are like three different use cases, but nowhere in there am I really considering that there's an interference effect related to mechanisms. Cause I don't think that's true. Mm. I think that most of this sort of effect or outcomes that we see when they are different have to do with total training load, which is not unique to, like, combining aerobic and resistance training. It could be all resistance training. You can get, you know, non-functional overreaching, you know, sort of outcomes where you're doing too much training, you're not getting stronger or bigger. Same thing happens in endurance training too. So I think it's mostly related to training load rather than, like, mechanisms.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I don't think I have much more to add. I think that that's a wise training strategy going into a meet. And then definitely those who are not as trained, which is probably applicable to the vast majority of people listening to this, you probably don't need to worry about this too much, and you're probably not doing enough conditioning. So,
yeah, and even if, like, if you're in that middle kind of person, you know, that sort of second use case, I think that even if you do observe an interference effect, right, that you're like, look, my rate of improvement is not as high as it once was prior to adding conditioning in, or I'm not able to perform as well. I think all that's telling you is that your current training load right now is higher than it was. And it may be a little bit beyond your current ability to recover and adapt. I think most of the time I would tell people to just persist. There would be a handful of, like, we'll call them red flags, but I'm using that term very charitably here. Those red flags sort of events would be like, oh, you picked up an injury, right? Or an injury that was previously like minor and you didn't really have to do anything about it. You're just, you know, it's going to go away as now like declared itself. Mm-hmm. That would say that training load's a little high. Or if your performance drops by something like more than 10% and it stays there.
Sure.
To me, I'm like, yeah, okay. Now we've probably outkicked our coverage here.
Yeah, that resonates. I think that, you know, I went through something similar. And in the past year, as I said, I shifted a lot of my training in terms of the proportions and the direction and the goals to do quite a bit more conditioning. I was still strength training. I was using the rower. I was doing a bunch of other stuff. And as I've alluded to on some recent podcasts over the winter time, I did come down with a bout of some back pain that I think was mostly attributable to overall training load. And I've got that knocked out at this point by mitigating that. And, you know, as tends to be the case, we'll approach it a little bit more intelligently this second time around. I think also kind of jumping off the earlier point that I made where a lot of folks in the strength training space don't tend to do enough conditioning, the conditioning that they do, if they do it, tends to be too hard. And so the other aspect that we would suggest in this situation is if you are trying to do some conditioning and you feel you are observing an interference effect, go easier.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I like to set heart rate caps a lot in my own conditioning and those of the folks that I train. And I actually tend to be pretty conservative with the heart rate caps that I set. So I like doing, you know, if I'm going to do some low and slow, long, steady conditioning, keeping my heart rate, you know, below 135, you know, something like that in the 120 to 130, 135 range, maybe getting up to 140. But even that, I might like back off a tiny bit to get a little lower than that. And that makes it so that I can do a fair amount and I feel completely fine afterwards with minimal residual fatigue. And then that's where I'll tend to notice kind of the least impact on other activities. Whereas if you feel like you should be doing high intensity intervals, definitely if you're doing truly high intensity intervals and pushing for 4 minutes on, that's very, very tiring if you're truly doing it, quote unquote, right. And I would expect to not feel awesome if I went to try to squat certainly the same day after something like that at this level. So,
yeah. Yeah. One of the things I hope that the research elucidates later is just the idea of like, all right, we're going to pair resistance training and conditioning work together in the same session, conditioning coming after the resistance training portion versus it being spread by like some amount of time. I know there's been a handful of investigations into this only with like equivocal results, but a lot of the methodology here is sus,
yeah,
to use the term of the youth. So mm-hmm. We'll see if stuff like that comes up, and then also identifying maybe like the best benchmarks for here's how much conditioning volume you're doing versus resistance training volume. Here's how you would, you know, total training load and like, you know, maybe some sort of general guidelines there. Maybe we'll do that. Who knows?
Sure.
Yeah, as long as we're just making stuff up anyway. So. All right. Well, that is a wrap here on the March 2025 research review on the Barbell Medicine podcast. Before we go again, we do have a pain and rehab seminar coming up May 17th through 18th in Buffalo, New York. If you're a PT, if you're AT, if you're a strength coach, if you're just a person who wants to be better at managing your own pain or those around you, check that out. Link is in the description below. New templates are out. So we've got the Strength 1 Gen 2, we've got the second generation hypertrophy 1, and then this month, the Strength 2 and Strength 3 templates all coming out. So keep an eye on your inbox for those. If you've subscribed to the Barbell Medicine newsletter, if you're not, and you want to stay apprised of what we're doing here at Barbell Medicine, go to the website. There'll be a pop-up, put your email in there and we'll keep you in the loop. And again, March is nutrition month. And so 20% off all of our supplements, use the code nutrition20 at checkout. Also check out the articles on heart rate variability and training with limited time. Before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.